welcome to another episode of Rustation Station. I'm your host, Alan Wima. Today, I have a very special guest. It is Marty Jones. So, Marty Jones is a software developer based out of Brooklyn, originally from the Midwest, near where I'm from. So, we're just kind of catching up before the show. In fact, we catched up for too long, I think. And yeah, he has a very interesting library that came out called Purdy. So, I actually just tried to do a Google search on Purdy before, and I couldn't find it. So, it took me some time to find. But in any case, it's pretty interesting. I was trying to find kind of some more interesting pieces about like what it's about, you know, why do we have this, but I can go ahead and let you take care of that. Why don't you first start off just kind of telling us, you know, who you are and why you started making this library?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me, Alan. Yeah, I am obviously a software engineer. I've been professionally writing software for about 6 years now. And before that, I was a hobbyist and was just really interested in programming. I started doing it on the side. I learned Python and just kind of built silly little programs and tried to find cool things to build. And then in 2016, I was working for a solar company and had an opportunity to build some software for them. And that ended up being kind of what launched my professional career. I went to work for a startup based out of Austin and have spent the last 6 years building software for startups focused on the web. So I've spent a lot of time working on the client side on the web, and then also working on like backend APIs, and saw the light in 2019 when I got some exposure to Rust. And that was my first experience with kind of some of the things that are not necessarily unique to Rust, like strong typing, but are certainly in their most extreme form in Rust, and had a great experience working in that language. So I've been a big fan of the language for the last few years. I've been hacking around on it for different things, the latest of which is obviously this PDF rendering library.
But yeah, you have actually a pretty interesting background when you started programming, right? Because you didn't, I don't think you went to school for programming, but you definitely weren't doing programming when you started getting into it, right? So can you kind of talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I studied business in school and spent the first couple of years out of school trying to find, you know, what I wanted to work on. And so I worked in corporate finance for a little bit and that didn't stick. And as I mentioned, I worked in solar for a little bit just because I was curious about the industry. And so at the time I was doing that, I was like climbing up on rooftops and stuff, like fixing solar panels. I figured out within the first couple of days that I didn't want to do that, but it was an interesting experience. So I was working for a company doing solar maintenance, and it's a very small company. It was just me and two other people. And the founders of the company needed to generate some reports to be sent out to their customers to show how much they were saving by using solar energy. And as I mentioned, very small company, they had really no technical abilities, at least not as programmers. And so they were looking to hire someone to do that. And I was a hobbyist at the time, and it seemed like a great opportunity to try and put my skills to use, and very low risk for them because I was already there. It wasn't like it was going to cost them any extra money. So I hacked around on that and figured out I'm sure I would laugh if I like looked back at the code now, but figured out a solution to generate those reports and send them out over email. And it was a great experience. And I think for anyone who is listening to this, who is new to programming or maybe new to Rust and trying to find some way to make it work, that's one thing I learned from doing that experience was that you can just grab at whatever's available, and it might not be perfect, but it'll probably take you to somewhere that you didn't necessarily realize you were going to go. Like I didn't realize that at the time that I picked this project up that I was going to start working in software engineering. That wasn't necessarily my goal, but obviously ended up working out that way.
It's pretty interesting that your first kind of project was about PDFs, and then this is all about PDFs. Is it kind of what sparked this whole thing, or no relation?
It is funny. It's purely a coincidence. I did that and then didn't touch PDFs as a programmer for a few years. But I think it's interesting because PDFs are so ubiquitous, and there's such a large part of what we interact with on the web that you're kind of bound to run into them. I happened to run into it with my first ever project generating PDF reports. And then I was kind of focused on the web for a few years and then eventually ran into it building another application. So I think you're kind of inevitably going to run into PDF stuff if you're building for the web, because it is so much of the web. I think it's maybe 20 or 30% of the documents on the web are PDF. So it's definitely something you will definitely run into at some point.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I suppose so. I mean, PDFs, from what I remember, are basically all about like trying to make a standard way of printing documents. I think that was kind of the original idea of PDFs. Do you know the history of it?
Yeah, invented as a standardized way to print documents, really a standardized way to lay documents out. And for that reason, so the first PDF spec was published in like 91. So it's a very old technology at this point. And it really wasn't designed with a lot of the use cases that it's used for today. Obviously, things have gone increasingly paperless. And yet PDFs continue to get more and more usage today because the fact that they are, you know, displayed consistently from one system to another and have a consistent layout and don't change sizes as you resize them and obviously can be printed, you know, with high fidelity and consistently are very appealing for a lot of use cases. But the structure of the document is really not made to be easily worked with in like a web context. It's really just the format of the document, if you look at it, is just describing how to draw things on a page using very basic primitives. So there's a lot of complicated problems when it comes to handling PDFs because it's again, not made for kind of the way that we interact with it today. So there's a lot of fun challenges and interesting things you can do with them or interesting ways you can work on it.
What kind of primitives are actually built into PDF? And what if you want to extend PDF? Is it something you can do or you have to get part of the spec?
Yeah, so the primitives that make up the PDF, I think there's a dozen primitives that make it up. And these are things that all programmers will be familiar with for the most part. So it's things like numbers, strings, arrays, dictionaries, and there's several others. So those are like the core components of a PDF. If you like crack it open and look at the inside of a file, a lot of it will look sort of human readable, but then there's a bunch of pieces of it that are encoded in like non-ASCII characters. So it's not really meant for humans to interact with it, but you can definitely make out a structure when you crack it open. In terms of extending the format, I'm sure that people have done it, but I don't know. Kind of the like defining rule of what makes a valid PDF is if you can get Adobe Acrobat to render it. That's really what defines a valid PDF. The spec is like a subset of what Adobe Acrobat does. There's a bunch of like hidden functionality and just edge cases that that program covers that is not captured in the spec.
So what kind of edge cases are we talking about that are not in the spec?
A lot of it has to do with just things that weren't necessarily defined in the spec, but you might still have in a file, but that allow it to render. For example, like very, very large numbers. The spec doesn't define any way that you need to handle very, very large numbers, but Adobe has ways of gracefully handling that. And another example might be, and I don't think this is addressed in the spec, I definitely have not read the entire thing. I'm working my way through it very, very slowly, but there's a bunch of weird things you can do with a PDF. Like for example, as I mentioned, you have these non-ASCII characters. So you get this kind of output when you're compressing content in a PDF. And you do that obviously because you can save space. But one quirk because of the primitives and the way that you can compress content in a PDF is you could create a PDF that is 100 megabytes or 1 megabyte, but then when you go to parse it, the content that's compressed is compressing other content. And so you have this kind of recursive blowing up that will happen if you try to naively parse the file. And so Adobe Acrobat is handling all kinds of cases like that under the hood. And obviously it's a proprietary piece of software, so it's hard to know exactly what it's doing until you run into a PDF in the wild that is doing something like that, either, you know, just by accident because some PDF program generated it in a weird way or because someone constructed it specifically to be that way.
So how would you actually kind of reverse engineer something like this? I mean, do you literally just take a PDF and try to parse it and then it fails and then you open up an Adobe Acrobat and try to think about what's happening? Or how would you figure out, you know, how to solve these edge cases?
I think the main challenge, as I understand it from reading about people who have successfully built PDF software before, is just running into these things. And then, you know, if you're building a program around them, generally speaking, you can figure out what's going on. This is not like super complicated technology, but there's so many different edge cases that a lot of companies that are building PDF software have to spend a lot of time. If you're building from scratch, you have to spend a lot of time supporting all of these things. And there's no great catalog of all of the different things you need to support. And so it's really a matter of running into them in the wild, which I think for a lot of companies seems like it happens when you have a customer that's using your software and your software blows up and isn't handling their PDF correctly. And so you take a look at the PDF and you kind of diagnose and see what's going on. And obviously Adobe has had a long head start of doing that with their software.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious about how these kind of things even get started. I mean, it must be that Adobe sets a standard for themselves and then people somehow can do it. I don't know. I'm just kind of curious about how you get this kind of edge cases that happen that are like undocumented specifications.
Yeah, I forget the exact saying, but I read somewhere that I think this was in relation to, there's a really good article out there on Stripe and how Stripe obviously has a large public API that you can use. And that API defines things like character limits on a lot of the inputs that you're passing in. But when a system gets to a certain size and has a certain number of users, the spec and what's defined, you know, in terms of how you're supposed to use the API no longer matters. And it's really just a matter of what you can do with it. And so in Stripe's case, they had like no enforcement of character limits on a bunch of fields in their API. And so at one point in their scaling journey, they discovered that there were all these fields in their database that were much longer than they were intended to be because they weren't enforcing it at the data level, like at the database level, and they weren't enforcing it at the API level. And so people were using it in ways that they didn't expect. And I think that's kind of what's happened with PDFs over time. Adobe Acrobat is very flexible. So you can generate a PDF that doesn't conform to the spec. And because Adobe Acrobat is so flexible and because that was kind of the predominant PDF piece of software for a long time, as long as you could get a file to open in Acrobat, that was fine. And Adobe covered all of these different issues. So you had this proliferation of software that generated funky and kind of malformed PDFs. And eventually it's just the nature of the industry now that what Acrobat supports is the spec, and you have to conform to that if you want to build PDF software.
I'm kind of curious about, like, this to me seems like a very good use case to do something like property-based testing. Have you looked at something like that?
I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah, so property-based testing is like where you can define a couple of like properties of your software and then let this testing software just generate random input, kind of like Chaos Monkey or something like that, and then see if your system can handle all this stuff. So quite a few like bugs have been found this way, like if you send certain strings or integers, if your system doesn't handle them properly, then you'll find out when it doesn't get generated properly. So like, for instance, I mean, if you say, you know, two numbers between, you know, if you say, okay, my system, all it does is it just takes two numbers, two integers, add them together, give me a new integer, which is the sum of those two numbers. So you can generate, let's say, okay, give me a random integer, give me two random integers, add those together, and then that should be the output. And so some things that you may be able to catch is like overflows, right? So then you have to be able to say, oh, okay, let's show an error if these numbers added together is larger than, you know, an integer, like a 64-bit integer or something like that. These kind of things. They use these kind of things a lot for like databases and drivers and things like that, because you get random input that you have to be able to handle and not explode, right? So that's why I was thinking maybe property-based testing could add some value to your library. I'm not too sure. I haven't actually played with it before, but I'm aware of what it is.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense to me. I think this is definitely one of those use cases where you're dealing with essentially random input. You just have no idea if you go to, well, I guess it depends on who's using the library and what they're using it for. But if you're trying to design a general purpose PDF rendering library, which is the goal for Purdy, you are essentially dealing with random input. So yeah, that seems like that would definitely be a valid use case or a valid testing case.
Yeah, it could be something you could take a look at. But I mean, they take a while to run, right? Because you just need to keep running it for some time. I mean, you could say, okay, run this for a half hour or something like that on the CI. Because yeah, I mean, it's just really random. You can't control it. But the other thing that's pretty cool too is that when it does the property-based testing, it tries to find like the lowest common denominator for that. I forgot how it actually works, but they try to like, they find a case and then they try a couple more cases that are related to that. And then they try to figure out some type of pattern to it. And then they reply back to you saying, okay, this is like the lowest common denominator of what would happen. So maybe like what would come back would be like one plus and then the biggest number it can handle. But it may find out that like, you'll take like a number that's double the bigger numbers you can handle, plus another 30 or something like that, so that you have an idea about what could be the problem.
Yeah, that's really smart. Are there libraries that you can use for this or products that you can use for this that you're aware of? I'd like to read more about it.
In Rust, I'm not too sure, but I know Erlang has a lot. Haskell has it. In Erlang, I think it's called Proper, P-R-O-P-E-R. There's a video on Computerphile on YouTube that talks about this, and I think they use Erlang as the example.
Cool.
I mean, Erlang is a good example because like you have to handle like, it was built for telecommunications, so you have to be able to handle like all these kind of data input, binary input, so you need to be able to handle these kind of things. I'm sure there must be something written in Rust. If not, I would be quite surprised, but then I'm sure you can probably add in C or C++ to make it happen.
Right. Yeah, that definitely seems like that would be valuable at some point down the line. Right now, this testing strategy is kind of, I have a sample PDF that I'm building out by hand, because the format is kind of, if you're not dealing with compressed content, you can edit it by hand. And so as I add new things that I'm supporting to the library, I have one PDF that kind of renders a bunch of random junk, and I sort of go and fill that out and then run it through the program and see how it outputs. And eventually I'd like to set up regression testing where I'm comparing the generated output of the program with what's expected, or maybe even what comes out of Acrobat. And I think I'll get some mileage out of that, but obviously, yeah, the random testing would be great too.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think if there's a way that you can somehow like randomly generate a PDF and then compare the output. So like I think they call those golden tests, where you can compare what something gets rendered if they look about the same. That would be interesting to see.
Yeah, well, the nice thing about PDFs is there's a lot of them out there. So you can always go and you have a catalog of PDFs that exhaust a lot of different test cases, I'm sure. Or even if you just found some random source of them, you would uncover a lot of cases either in the parsing phase or in the rendering phase very quickly.
So some people collect baseball cards, Pokemon cards, things like that. You're collecting PDFs. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. It's funny because it's not something I thought I would be interested in, but as I've gotten more and more into it, the fact that it's such an old technology, and the fact that there's so much complexity is not the right word to it, because it's not like really hard to understand any of it, at least not so far, but there's so many quirks to the way PDFs do things is kind of what's made it like more and more interesting to dive deeper into. It's just completely unlike anything I've worked on before. So it's been kind of fun.
Okay. Okay, but let's kind of fast forward right now, right? So what was the kind of the deciding factor that got you into creating this library to begin with?
Yeah, so I mentioned this earlier, but if you spend enough time working on the web, developing web apps, you will eventually run into a situation where you need to work with PDFs. And that happened to me a couple of years ago. I was working on a side project trying to build an application that lets users extract financial data from PDFs. And it wasn't that interesting of an application, but it was just something to hack on for fun. And I quickly discovered that there weren't a lot of great open source options when it came to rendering and manipulating PDFs on the web. So the most popular library out there that a lot of people will be familiar with is PDFJS, which is a really cool library developed by Mozilla, I think. It's still developed by Mozilla, but there's a lot more community involvement now as it's gotten larger. And that's a JavaScript library built on the 2D canvas that's able to render PDFs. And I would say in a limited way, allow you to also interact with them. So you can do some text extraction and figure out where text is on the PDFs. It's difficult to work with, but you can do some PDF manipulation with the library. So I started playing around with PDFJS for my use case, and I found it very difficult to use. And again, I don't think that's a reflection of the library so much as it is the complexity of PDF rendering. And I was wondering, like, why is this the case? PDFs have been around for so long, and it's like just a document format. It doesn't seem like it'd be that hard to handle. And it was obviously a very naive opinion. So I discovered all of these quirks and interesting things about PDFs as I looked further into it, and it made a lot of sense why there were no really great open source libraries out there. PDFJS is very cool as an experimental library, but has a lot of limitations. So really, if you want to do serious work with PDFs, your only option, as far as I'm aware, is to use like a commercial SDK, of which there are some very good ones on the market. I think PDFtron is a very popular one, and there are several others. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And the more I looked into it, the more I realized that just working on PDFs in Rust, which is the language I had been using for a little bit at that point, looked like an interesting problem to work on, because I didn't see a ton of effort being put towards PDF rendering in Rust. There are one or two libraries out there, but as I kind of got deeper into it, I felt like there was a little bit of, maybe an opportunity is the wrong word, because I think it's a kind of a Herculean task, but there's something interesting in trying to solve that problem. And so started working on it and tried a couple of different ways and, you know, learned some lessons working on it on and off for maybe a year or so. And then eventually came to kind of what Purdy is, which is the web GPU based version of a PDF renderer. And I've been working on that off and on for a few months.
It's just a good question. Like, I had never heard of WebGPU. Like, what is WebGPU, and does it actually interact with my own GPU? Is it like a driver interface to my actual GPU on my machine?
Yeah, so WebGPU is a project that is still very much in the early stages of development that is an abstraction layer to work with the GPU on the web. And so I think there's experimental support for it in all major browsers at this point. So you have to like go and turn on a flag to be able to use it. But the idea is that you could replace some of the popular options for working with the canvas in the browser with WebGPU. So right now you would use like the 2D canvas context or the WebGL canvas context. 2D is very high level, contains kind of basic drawing commands. That's what PDFJS is built on. WebGL is a little bit lower level. I think it's a web port of OpenGL. It's a little bit lower level, but it's kind of difficult to work with. And it's certainly not a low level abstraction over the GPU in the way that WebGPU is. And so this is a project that's been in the works for several years now and has experimental support and is, yeah, just a way that you can work with the graphics driver on a machine at a very low level. So it's probably closer to like Vulkan, if you're familiar with that library, than it is to like high level renderer.
Yeah, I've heard of Vulkan, but I couldn't quite wrap my mind around it. So it's like a higher level than low level kind of renderer, you're saying.
Yeah, I've never worked with Vulkan either. From what I understand, that's a good thing. It doesn't sound like a library that you generally want to work with. But if you think of if you had like a hierarchy of complexity, Vulkan would be very much near the bottom in terms of being like one of the most complex libraries to work with to manipulate the GPU. And as I understand it, WebGPU sits a little bit higher than Vulkan. Like there's a lot less boilerplate, but you still get like low level access to the GPU. And so you can use it to do graphics programming. That's kind of the use case that it's designed for, but you can also use it to do a lot of heavy compute work. And I think there are people out there who are doing stuff with it for that reason. So it is very, very low level.
So one of the questions I asked you over here, which is interesting, is kind of like, what is the point of this library, right? And I think you said that it's basically, one is that you want to have it be a renderer on the web, and two is that it's got good documentation is kind of one of your goals, right?
Yeah, I think from working with PDFJS, this is like a very ambitious goal, and I'm realistic to know that a difficult thing to achieve. But from working with PDFJS, I felt like it would be really cool to try and design something that is able to render PDFs with, you know, high fidelity and like close accuracy to the way that Acrobat can do that. And I mean, that in and of itself is a huge challenge, but then also is like native to the web and is able to be used and extended for the web. I think that PDFJS has some challenges. The first challenge is it's built on the 2D canvas, which is very high level and doesn't match the PDF graphics model. And there's a great video on this that people can find on YouTube called What is Unique? PDF Rendering. And it walks through why high-level renderers like the 2D canvas don't do a good job mirroring the PDF graphics model. So that's one issue with PDFJS that has admittedly been, they've kind of worked around it in, you know, very impressive ways to where it does render a lot of PDFs with, you know, really good quality, but it'll always have kind of that limitation unless they replace the back end. And then the other thing is, yeah, this idea of having a library that's got good documentation, which is always easier to do when you're starting from scratch than working with an existing library. And I think it would be great to build something that's extensible and refactorable. And if you have something that's entirely built in Rust, one of the great benefits of Rust is it's very easy, or at least easier, to refactor, and certainly has a lot of great documentation tools built in also. So yeah, those are some things I would love to achieve in the long term with the library.
But like, why would I want to use this to render a PDF when basically Chrome can already open up a PDF directly? Like, I could just stick it into an iframe or something like that. Why would I want to use this to render a PDF versus just letting the browser do it itself?
Yeah, if you have a use case for PDFs that doesn't require you to do any kind of interaction with them in the browser, I think your best bet is definitely to use Chrome's built-in renderer, which is PDFium. It's like a C or C++ based renderer that is very good at rendering the PDF graphics model. But as soon as you start having to interact with PDFs, that library is, I don't want to say it's impossible to work with, but it's very difficult to work with. And you have to compile it yourself and it becomes a lot more complicated. So I would say, depending on the kind of project you're doing, if you're doing something that is rendering only, you can definitely get away with that. In the very, very long term, the goal with Purdy is that you have something that can render PDFs and then will also allow you to interact with them in some way. And you may have to build that function yourself, or that functionality might be included if it's something that's like highly reusable. But yeah, definitely geared around interactive use cases.
So maybe can you give some more specific use cases about, like, if you were to do this, Purdy would be the way to go. Or if you're just going to do this, then maybe Purdy's not the way to go, right? So something that is sticking to my mind is that PDFs, you can fill out a form. Would that be something that Purdy would excel at?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to make promises about Purdy because it is so early stage. But yeah, in the long term, what I would love for it to do is to be able to allow you to interact with forms in the way that people are used to doing in Acrobat. So, you know, in Acrobat, you can add annotations to a PDF, you can add signatures to it, you can fill out fillable fields. You know, I'm sure there are collaboration tools. And that's what a lot of the commercial SDKs do today as well. They allow you to interact with PDFs on the web in that way. And that's like the long-term vision, is to be able to do that, but with an open source library rather than something that's commercial.
Now, would you say that Purdy is kind of like a, what would you call this, like a glue to kind of put a couple of crates together and make everything work properly? Or it's actually going to be a rewrite of some of the things? Because I see over here at least two crates which you're using, Low PDF and Lion. There's also WGPU, which I'm guessing you're also using too, right? So like, how would you describe Purdy in this case?
Yeah, so Low PDF is a fantastic Rust-based PDF parsing library. And for Purdy, I've pulled a ton of code out of Low PDF and stuck that into a crate that I'm using to parse the PDFs that I'm rendering. In fact, that's the majority of the code in Purdy right now. It's either straight from Low PDF or it's a modification of code from Low PDF. I'm doing some things slightly differently from Low PDF, which is why I'm not using it as a direct dependency, but called it out in the README because a lot of what Purdy does right now is based on that. And it's a really cool library built using NOM, which is a parser combinator library built in Rust. That's very cool. So the goal of Purdy is not necessarily to build something that like sells at PDF parsing, but you have to be able to parse a PDF and get it laid out, you know, in memory and structures that you can interact with. So I have gained a lot from using Low PDF. And then Lion is a really cool library for working with. You can use it with WebGPU, but you can also use it with other low-level renderers. So the way that a lot of these low-level renderers work is they take triangles in and they use those to generate the output, the rendering output. Those triangles are like the primitive that low-level renderers like WebGPU use. And what Lion does is it's a really nice abstraction to be able to generate those triangles. So you can use Lion and describe something like draw a line from here to here and then fill it or stroke the line. And Lion is able to generate the triangles that are consumed by WebGPU. So, gluing together those concepts right now and then trying to take that and turn that into a library that is able to render PDF. So like one example of something that's unique to PDF rendering that has to be captured is if in a PDF, if you want to draw a line that has zero length and then you fill that line, that'll show up as one pixel. And if you do that with like another high level 2D renderer, like say the 2D Canvas API, that will show up as nothing because it's zero length and you're filling something that's zero length. So it's one of those quirks of how PDFs render. And that's the kind of thing that Purdy is designed to implement, is trying to match that level of fidelity with how PDFs take instructions in and then generate output on the screen.
But if this is made for the web, like why not just stick to the JavaScript? Why use Rust to do this kind of stuff?
I mean, the main reason is just that it's a lot of fun to work in Rust. I would not have as much fun. Actually, when I posted a link to Purdy on Reddit, someone commented and made a very good point of like, well, if you want to build like a web GPU based renderer, why not, you know, take advantage of PDF.js that already exists and just build a new backend for PDF.js, which is a totally valid and fair point. But for me, having worked on Rust for a few years, it's just a lot of fun to build things in Rust. And I don't think I would enjoy building a library like this in another language as much, because it wouldn't feel like there was as much potential. And just frankly, it wouldn't be as much fun to work on day to day. So I think that that's probably the main motivation for it. And then the other motivation is nothing quite like this exists today in Rust. There are some Rust-based PDF renderers that use like higher level libraries, but it does seem like something that would be handy for the community to have. And I think if there's any kind of momentum that is gained by people wanting to work on something like this, I definitely don't have the skills to do it all by myself, but I'm confident that Rust has a community that is full of people who can help move something like this forward.
So in terms of like, where is Purdy at right now and kind of like, what's the immediate timeline? Like, you know, like what features you plan to add within the next coming months?
Yeah, it's a good question. So Purdy is very early stages, very, very early stages. I haven't even exposed the WebAssembly bindings for it. So you can't even grab it and start using it in the browser. And I did that because I don't want people to try and use it and be frustrated when they realize that it doesn't do basically anything right now. So the cases that I'm working through, the video that I mentioned earlier on YouTube, it's about a 30-minute long video by a person who has a, or had at the time, it's a little bit older now, but a PDF software company. And he basically walks through all of the ways in which PDF rendering is unique from other renderers. And the kind of the first series of things that the video covers is how PDFs do shape drawing and what's unique about how PDFs draw shapes. So going off of that, I'm working on implementing PDF drawing capabilities. So these are like the drawing commands that comprise something like what you would see in SVG or on the 2D canvas, but that are unique to PDFs. And so that's where Lion has come in handy. So it's things like drawing lines, drawing simple shapes, adding fills, adding colors, those kinds of sort of primitive functions. And once I get that done, I'll probably move on to some of the other things in that video. There's quite a bit to get through there, but things around you know, how you deal with anti-aliasing, how you deal with image transforms, blend modes, all of that stuff is really interesting. And as mentioned in the video, is unique to PDF rendering. So I think if you're going to build a PDF renderer, you kind of have to figure out how you're going to solve those problems because they are unique. And then there's obviously a whole range of other things that need to be solved, like rendering text and rendering kind of the other stuff that you expect to be able to do when you're building a PDF. So I haven't built together a roadmap yet. I'm just kind of working my way through those things and taking them one at a time.
The link you're talking about, is this the same one as you sent to me in the resources section?
Yeah, it's a video on YouTube called What is Unique About PDF Rendering? And the man who's presenting is, I think his name is Hans Burfus. I'm not sure how to pronounce him, but he has a software company that renders PDFs.
I tried to go to the link a few times, but it keeps saying the video is not available anymore. I don't know, maybe it's not available or what happened. It's really weird.
That's strange. Yeah, I last time I watched it was a couple of days ago, so I'm not sure what happened, but I wonder if maybe a regional thing.
Could be. I know, it's really weird because it kind of shows up for a second and all of a sudden it flips over to the video is not available anymore. The video isn't available anymore.
It's just funny because I saved it locally just in case it did go offline. So I wonder if maybe it's got taken down since then.
Taken down by Big Acrobat.
That's right. Oh, yeah, I have it here. Maybe I just sent the raw. I put the long link in that document. So I'll drop that in. But yeah, anyone can find that on YouTube and I highly recommend watching it. It's a very informative guide on kind of how PDF rendering is different from other sort of rendering systems.
Now, I'm kind of curious though, like, is there any relation to your current job? Because your current job is also dealing with documents too, right?
I just started with a company, it's based out of San Francisco called Lawya, which is a document automation startup. It's a subsidiary of a larger legal tech company, Clio, which is a Canadian company. And what Lawya does is makes it easier for lawyers to file court forms, which are PDF in PDF format, generally speaking. And so there's a bunch of PDF technology that we use. Purdy is not in use, very early stage, so wouldn't be useful for much of anything at Lawya. But yeah, I started this job recently and part of the draw for me was being able to get more exposure to PDFs and how software developers work with them day to day. So it's a new thing for me, but yeah, definitely kind of aligned with the mission.
Now, are they aware that you're working on this?
I think I mentioned it to them. It's not something that the company has any involvement with, but I would love to get to a point someday where we're able to use it at Lawya. That would be great. Right now, we're using a commercial SDK to get our PDF stuff done.
Yeah, that could be interesting. Yeah, I think this is pretty interesting. I can imagine how using this could be good for web applications. Because like I said, that using iframe, I mean, it works, but it's not so integrated, I think.
Yeah. Well, people are coming to expect to being able to interact with PDFs in, you know, in a lot of different ways, becoming a lot more used to that. That's kind of the impetus for a lot of what Lawya does. And there are a bunch of other companies out there that are trying to make it easier. You can build entire businesses off of making it easier for people to work with PDFs and automate filling out information and just make it easier to collaborate. And that's what these commercial SDKs, they've enabled a lot of these applications to be built. And they're phenomenal products. And I don't think Purdy will probably ever match the quality of some of these things. But it is interesting. And I think it's good for the ecosystem to have different ways of trying to solve these problems. And part of the reason I published Purdy is trying to find people who are interested in, you know, building something like this on Rust, because there's really no reason why Rust, there's no reason why it wouldn't be a great choice for something like this. It's a huge undertaking, but I think the language is really well suited to it. And I think WebGPU is also probably very well suited to it.
Yeah, I think so too, especially like it's WebAssembly stuff, but Rust is really one of the most supported languages for it. And doing high performance work too. Of course, Rust is very fantastic at that too.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. I mean, is there anything else you want to say more about Purdy? And maybe you could talk about why it's called Purdy. I guess it's supposed to be a play on the word pretty.
Yeah. Honestly, I was just trying to think of a name before I published it a week ago. And I wanted to have something that had P in the name because of kind of the, I forget what the term is called, but you know, PDF starts with P also. So I wanted to have some kind of association there. And Purdy was the first thing that came to mind, and I didn't want to put too much thought into it, so just published it. And I should make sure that there are no other projects that have that name out there. But yeah, that's the name for now, at least. Open to changing it.
Yeah, I'm surprised that nobody's squatting on the name, right? This seems to be an issue of people squatting on names in the Rust community, sadly. But
yeah, I don't know how it works with naming things. Like, if you have an open source project, you're obviously not trying to profit off of it. So I wonder what the what trademark issues there are around that. I haven't given that a whole lot of thought, but yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if there's something else out there named Purdy, whether it's in Rust or otherwise.
Let's hope, you know, yours is not going to be like LeftPad, where I think one of the, what actually happened, you remember LeftPad? You remember the whole entire issue of LeftPad?
Yeah, that was, the guy took the library down, right? And then a bunch of stuff started not compiling.
But it all came from, if I remember correctly, let me know if I'm wrong in the audience or if you know more. What I remember, it actually came from one of his other libraries had the same name as another company's product, I think. I think it was actually HipChat, which from Atlassian or something. NPM just yanked it down without really talking to him or something like that. And so he just got upset and just yanked everything down, including LeftPad, and that kind of broke everything. So you got to be careful if you just yank stuff down, right? And comply with, you know, whatever kind of issues people have with you, if you have similar product names or whatever.
Yeah. It's a big, complicated legal world out there now. And when you're building something for free, I can imagine it'd be very frustrating to have someone start coming after you for copyright infringement.
Yeah. I mean, they also don't, you know, people don't want to be associated with certain projects, right? So, or sometimes they just want to flex their muscle for whatever. Who knows why they do certain things, but I guess it's their legal right.
Yeah. But yeah, on Purdy, anyone who's interested in kind of contributing, you know, I would welcome it. It's a, like I said, it's a very early stage project. So if you know anything about WebGPU, you know anything about PDFs, or if you are just interested in Rust and you have an interest in contributing to it, you know, feel free to take a look at the repository, and I'm happy to chat with anyone who might have an interest.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say, is that you're looking for contributors or anybody who's interested, probably even some guinea pigs who want to check it out, no?
Yeah, I actually had someone who tried to run it on a Windows machine and had ran into some kind of issue with the parsing component, trying to parse the sample file that I use. So I'm sure there are a lot of things like that that'll be uncovered as people hopefully start playing with it, which is great because that helps to, every little issue that's uncovered helps to increase the coverage, the test coverage for the code that exists already. But yeah, I would love to have contributors. And I think the estimate from the video that I mentioned a couple of times about what it takes to build a PDF renderer was that it's about 10 developer years. So that's like 10 years of a developer working 40 hours a week. So a big motivation for me in open sourcing it was there's no way I'm going to be able to develop to get this library done in 10 developer years, just because I don't have that kind of time to devote to it. So I would love to get other people on board. And that's definitely one of the goals for me, is to get the library in a place where people can contribute to it.
Yeah, I think that's kind of part of the problem, is like it's a supply demand kind of issue where it's like you're demanding people to kind of help. Well, not really demanding, but you know what I mean. But yeah, you basically have to supply enough that it's useful for people, and then they're going to contribute back. That's kind of my thoughts about open source, is, you know, if even if you have an idea, it depends on you. If the idea is so attractive, people can come and help out, right? You mentioned that you listened to the Liberty OS episode. I think it was just the idea of building an OS is what attractive, and people are coming to help them out. but he doesn't have enough like a Redux or even a Linux or even maybe Herd, this kind of kernel experience, this kind of kernel even built to for it to be usable for people to actually say, I want to contribute to it. I think for your kind of project, you need to have something that can be usable from it that people can actually use, and then they'll contribute back. That's my own thoughts.
Yeah, that seems like a very reasonable take. And it's hard with really ambitious projects to figure out what to ship that is useful and then gets people also interested. So I'm sure it'll be a great learning process for me as I kind of dip my toes into open source.
I mean, 10 developer years. I'm just kind of curious, like with you having a family, a job and all this stuff, like what is it that, how do you find time to actually work on this? Or is it just, you know, such a high priority to you that you can easily make time for it?
I definitely have fits and starts with it and periods of time where I don't do anything on it. So I think my philosophy on this and on side projects in general is that as long as you enjoy what you're working on and you're not putting, you know, so much pressure on yourself that it becomes no longer enjoyable, then you can kind of take on whatever like level of ambition you want. Purdy is like it's a hugely ambitious project. And if I was trying to build a business out of it or something, it would be a non-starter as an idea because it's just too large. But as something that I work on, in the evenings and on the weekends as I have time, and then don't work on it when I'm on vacation or have other stuff going on, that's fine. I think that's kind of, I'm okay with that balance of, you know, maybe the project doesn't make the kind of progress I would like, but it's fun to work on when I work on it. And, you know, it's open source. Maybe it doesn't end up ever becoming something that's usable, but then a few years down the line, someone sees it and, you know, they build their own project and take some inspiration from it. That would be okay too.
Okay. Yeah. So if there's nothing else, then I just have a couple of wrap up questions for you. Maybe just give you one last chance to say anything else. Maybe you can tell people how to reach out to you.
Cool. Yeah, you can find me on Twitter. It's Murdy Jones. That's my handle. So it's Marty Jones, but with a U instead of an A. And then you can also find me at GitHub with the same handle.
So I'm starting to see the Purdy and Marty and Murdy. Some kind of any relation or no?
No relation between those two, although maybe there's something subliminal going on there that I didn't realize because it definitely looks a little fishy. But no, I have my email is a variation of the U instead of the A. And the guy who owns the actual email with my name has gotten a lot of emails that were intended for me. And I feel really bad for him. So in hindsight, I wish I had just added a number to the end of my name. That seemed like that would have been the smartest thing to do. But, you know, that's okay.
Yeah, I hear this problem a lot. I've gotten people sending me links to people who are not the right people. I remember when I was working in the bank, we had a guy come in to give a speech named Dave Thomas. Well, there's actually two Dave Thomases out there. One is the guy from Pragmatic Programmers, who's also involved in the Agile Manifesto. They gave out his bio, and I know him, all right? I have contact with him. So I sent him a message. I said, hey, I didn't know you're coming to Hong Kong. He said, what are you talking about? I said, I got this email saying you're coming to speak in person. And he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. And I did some checking, and it's actually another guy named Dave Thomas, who's also in technology, who's actually local to out here or Singapore or something like that. So it's just even the HR is making mistakes like this. So it's kind of funny, which I'm surprised that someday I don't get a bio about Dave Thomas, the guy who created Wendy's at this point. It's another Dave Thomas.
Having a name that's really common. I mean, Marty Jones it's a pretty common name, and it can be kind of nice because it's like a little bit more anonymous, which is cool. But then there's also just a lot of other people you can be mistaken with, and it's a very common name. So if you Google Marty Jones, you're going to find an English wrestler from the 80s who I have no relation to. And I don't think my picture will ever crack the first page of Google because he's so much more popular than I am. So definitely one of those things people don't anticipate when they name their kids.
Let's not forget that Rust also has this issue too, right? There's a TV show, I think Rust, is also a video game named Rust. And then there's Rust itself. And let's not forget Rust, I think, is the name of the what is it? The fungi that this is kind of named after. So of course, the actual Rust itself.
It's very difficult to Google things in Rust, I find, because if you're Googling like specific programming things, you're okay. But if you're like looking for libraries, sometimes it's just not enough. It's not enough info. Like if you look for like a PDF library in Rust, if you Google Rust PDF, you're not even going to be close. It's so hard to find information about Rust PDF libraries. So it's very difficult. Yeah. It's definitely a very common word chosen for a language.
Similar with Go, right? You've tried to look up things for Go. It took me forever to figure that out. Then I figured out just type Golang is much easier than Go.
Yeah, Rust needs to adopt that. Rustlang. You need to adopt that language for searching for things.
I think they have that. Okay, then I think I just have a couple of topics that were last, right? So actually just one last question, which is kind of a jumble of questions, which is, do you have any tips or tricks for beginners for Rust or any kind of warnings to give to them?
Yeah, when I was starting out with Rust, I was very confused by kind of the error handling. And obviously the borrow checker is just like legendary and being incredibly difficult to work with. So if you're starting out with Rust and you're not very comfortable with these concepts, which is totally normal and to be expected, I would just highly recommend that you unwrap things very liberally. There's nothing wrong with unwrapping when you're trying to figure things out. And also use the clone method very liberally. And that will help you to get around a lot of the borrow checker issues. So I would definitely not shy away from doing those things. And then when you get more experienced, you'll understand how you can avoid using those things and kind of work with some of Rust's more, I guess, idiosyncratic ways of doing things. And in terms of warnings for beginners, I think it's great to invest time into Rust. I would highly recommend it. I think it's an awesome language and it's going to be used for a lot more applications in, you know, the next few years. I'm sure that we'll see companies that are founded on Rust, but it's not good to be sucked into thinking that any specific language is going to be like a defining thing for your career. The things that you work on, like the projects and the products that you work on, are a lot more important than what language you work in. So, you know, whether you're working in Rust or you're working in TypeScript or Go or whatever your topic is, you can do a lot of valuable things. So I would pursue Rust mainly if it's something that's interesting to you, not necessarily as a way to move your career forward.
Okay. I think that's good points. And with that, I think, you know, we're good. I really appreciate your time on here. Maybe you can come back again when you're a little bit farther along and kind of see where you are. I wouldn't be surprised if this library changes a bit in its focus, because there's a lot you can do with PDFs. And yeah, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me on. And yeah, I'd love to come back at some point when Purdy is a little more mature. And who knows what the name will be then.
Yeah.